It's okay. That was nice enough. I'm going to start because I feel badly that we're already late. Okay, good evening. First of all, thank you everybody for coming. It is definitely very, very nice to be back in Renot. It's been a while, but it's always nice to come back. So I wanted to speak tonight. I think if you ask any Stanford audience, I know this is definitely true of my own students at Stern. If you ask any standard audience of people that learn on a consistent basis, that are really involved in the process of learning Tanakh, to list the few Svarim that they want to get back to one day, but they never really got around to doing, again, in my experience, Ezra Nehemiah is always at the top of that list, right? It's that Sefer that you always want to learn, you're not really 100% sure what it's about, you never really got around to it, but you will one day. And I think it really makes a lot of sense, because I think Ezra Nehemiah is intimidating for a number of reasons. Thank you so much. I think that Ezra Nehemiah is intimidating because a large portion of it is in Aramaic, which is always something that people find troubling. And aside from that, it's just a very complicated sefer in its own right. There are a lot of historically speaking inconsistencies in terms of chronology, order of kings, when they appear. And the sefer itself is not, we're going to speak of a couple of reasons why, but the sefer itself is not really in keeping with your standard historical narrative that we're used to when we speak about Yoshua, Shoftim, Malachim, etc. So I wanted to just give a very, very quick overview of the Sefer itself, and I call it specifically a Sefer. It is not two separate Svarim. I wanted to just give a quick overview and then move into really the topic that we're going to be speaking about tonight. So Ezra Nehemiah is basically a Sefer. It begins in 559 approximately BCE when Cyrus took over. Cyrus II, Cyrus the Great took over. He was really the first of the Achaemenid kings, and he began the Persian dynasty. And at the beginning of his reign, really, and this was a universal position that he adopted throughout his empire, but it's specific in terms of its implications for the Jews, he allowed people to rebuild the temples that had been destroyed when the Babylonians sacked many of the temples throughout the ancient Near East. One of the things, and in particular, again, as I mentioned in terms of the Jewish people, not only did he allow us to go back and rebuild the temple in Yerushalayim, but he also allowed what you might call the expatriates to return to become repatriates. He allowed the people that so chose to return and really do the building project themselves. The Sefer itself really tells of a couple of main accomplishments. The first, obviously, being the rebuilding of the temple and the restoration of sacrifice within that temple. The second one being in the days of Nehemiah, the rebuilding of the walls, which is something that I think for us as a modern audience is sometimes lost. But the rebuilding of the walls of a city really meant solidifying the city, protecting it from outsiders. And then really essentially the reinstitution of what was, which we're going to speak about and define in a couple of minutes. Along the way, there were also setbacks that the Sefer speaks about. And so the Sefer speaks about external opposition, people from the outside who didn't want them building, which is a whole topic in and of itself, why these people were resistant to the rebuilding. And it also speaks about internally the difficulties that the people had, the looseness with which they approached the covenant between them and God, the lack of familiarity with the text of the Torah, which we're going to speak about. And for the most part, that looseness, what you might call it, manifests in intermarriage. Intermarriage was a major issue. It threatened really the continuity of the people, and it was something that the leaders, which is what the Sefer speaks about, are the ways in which the leaders contended with these various issues, both the external and the internal opposition, and were able nonetheless to accomplish what they accomplished. One of the things, just as a backdrop, because again, I think this is something that, as a modern audience, we're slightly out of touch with as well. The backdrop to Sefer Ezra Nehemiah, we had basically what began in 597 and then really culminated in 586 BCE with the Chorban, with the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. The destruction of the Beit HaMikdash was a lot more than simply the destruction or the burning down of an important, pretty building. The religion, Israelite religion, really, for the most part, was a cultic religion. Okay, and we're going to speak a little bit more about this later on, but for the most part, the really centerpiece of our religion was the Beit HaMikdash. And the primary way of serving God was through worship in the Beit HaMikdash. And so the Kohanim and the Levim, really for the most part, were the quote-unquote keepers of the law. Now we're going to speak about what that means, but they were the ones that preserved, that knew the law. And your way really of connecting to God and connecting to religion was through the Beit HaMikdash. And so when the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed in the 6th century BCE, we didn't just lose a building, we lost... We basically lost really the central element of religion. Okay? Tack on top of that, being displaced from the land where we believed that we belonged, where we had sovereignty up until that point for the most part. Okay? And tack on top of that, the loss of the Davidic dynasty. Okay? The Davidic dynasty really had been the centerpiece from the days of David and on. The Davidic dynasty had ruled the people. And the people believed, and this was really something ideologically speaking that the Nevi'im had to contend with, the people believed that the Davidic dynasty was going to last for eternity. Okay? And so you're taking the three really main elements of a religion, knocking them out, and in many ways, really, I'm going to call it Judaism, even though it wasn't called Judaism yet, Israelite religion really had to ask some very serious existential questions. And one of the things that really we needed to contend with, or the leaders needed to contend with, was how do you survive once those elements are stripped away? Okay. Now, what I'm going to be totally skipping over now is diaspora Jewry and how the diaspora Jewry dealt with those issues and sort of redesigned or redeveloped religion in the diaspora. Those questions really in many ways are dealt with, I think really two separate answers are offered, but in the works of Daniel and Esther, you have really an approach to diaspora Jewry and what it means to exist as a Jew outside of Israel. What I want to do is skip over that portion of history and go back to Israel. Go back in during the period that we're speaking of Cyrus and look at how the leaders and how the people really reconstituted. How do you reconstitute when everything that constituted your religion up until that point had been torn apart, okay, had been taken away? And the question is really, do you recreate exactly what you had, right? Do you respond to the different reality that is your reality now? And if so, right, first of all, what is that different reality? How does it come into play? And how do those changes manifest themselves? And so these are really the questions that I think Ezra and Nehemiah, as we're going to see, deal with and address. There's one thing that I want to sort of touch upon tonight, which is a topic in its own right. But I think it's important whenever we study really any book that's considered a historical work within Tanakh. I think that in general, calling a work in Tanakh a historical work is somewhat of a misnomer. Not because they're not historically valid or accurate, and not because they don't tell or reflect the historical period in which they were written, but because, and I think this is something we all know by this point, because the works of Tanakh are not primarily historical books. You cannot take one single work in Tanakh and say, gee, I wonder what the early Iron Age was like in Israel. Maybe I'll go look at the, you know, period of Yehoshua, or, excuse me, at the period of Malachim, or, you know, I wonder what the, I wonder what those periods were like between 1200 and 1050 BCE. Let me whip open Sefer Shoftim. I'm going to get a real comprehensive look at that period. You don't get that. Okay? What the Sfarim in Tanakh are essentially ideological works. They're conveying an ideology. They convey a theology. They convey an ideology, all within the corpus of what we call Tanakh. And one of the ways in which, and again, I'm speaking now about the historical work, so Yehoshua, Shoftim, as opposed to, for example, the what we call the later prophets, Yeshayahu, Treasar, etc. What these quote-unquote historical works really essentially do is convey an ideology through the way in which they tell history, through the way they reflect on history, through the way they interpret history, okay, through the way in which they understand Israel's actions and God's reaction to those actions in history, to the way they understand our relationship to the land, to our fellow Israelites, etc. That being said, something that we also have to, I think, bear in mind is the way in which different Sfarim really contain nuanced differences in terms of what the way they reflect on history. Okay? Even works that are considered contemporaneous. Okay, so you could have, I mean, if you look at Yehoshua and Shoftim, for example, that overlap in terms of some of the wars that they speak about, you have differences in their accounts. It doesn't mean that one is right and one is wrong. It means that the way that they are reflecting on history, and, or I should say backwards, what they are trying to convey is being conveyed through the various lenses through which they're viewing history. Okay? I mean, if you take, for example, I remember when I was in Israel for the year and I had a friend who was from England and I was talking to her about the Revolutionary War. She'd never even heard of the Revolutionary War. Right? She thought it was a border skirmish because in England they teach about the border skirmish. Here we talk about our Revolutionary War. Okay? It's not a question of accuracy or inaccuracy. It's different lenses through which you convey things to create an ideology. I'm going to give one example from Ezra Nehemiah to give a sense of what I'm speaking about. Just understand sort of through contrast. If you look at your first sources, you have in Nehemiah, one of the things, sort of two of the issues that dovetailed really in the Sefer of Ezra Nehemiah is the issue of the delay in building the Beit HaMikdash. Okay, we're not going to speak now about the exact chronology, but it took a number of years from the time that Cyrus allowed them to go back and build the Beit HaMikdash until the building project was actually completed. And that was something that the leaders really had to contend with, and especially the spiritual leaders had to make sense of. Okay? Another issue which I mentioned sort of dovetails with the issue of the delay were the dire economic straits in which the people found themselves. They were, really, Nehemiah gives a very vivid picture of people having to sell their children into slavery. They barely had money they barely had crops to feed their own children, etc. If you look very interestingly in this first source, and in the interest of time, I'm going to be skipping over a lot inside, but everything I refer to is here, so feel free to do it on your own. If you look at the first source, you see that Nehemiah is essentially speaking about, thanks so much, the external opposition, okay, the enemies that didn't want, he speaks about the different people, he speaks about, these were sort of his nemesis throughout the Sefer, Sanballat, Tobiah HaAravi, the Ammoni, Ashdodim, that all came when they heard that he was on his way back to fix up the walls, and they were opposing basically his efforts. And a little bit later on in the in this parak, which I don't actually have quoted here, they also speak about, and Ezra speaks about this earlier on in the period, and Nehemiah later on, about the economic difficulties that really got in the way of the building project. Okay? If you look at Chagai Zechariah, oh, I do have that here, sorry, it's Nehemiah Parak Hei. If you look in Chagai Parak Aleph, okay, very interestingly, now Chagai Zechariah, there were a couple of Nevi'im that we're going to call contemporaries of Ezra Nehemiah. They weren't actually necessarily contemporaries of Ezra Nehemiah, the individuals, but we call them contemporaries because the Svarim of Chagai, Zechariah, Malachi speak of the same time period, or relatively the same time period, that the Sefer Ezra Nehemiah speaks of. And so we're going to use the word contemporaneous. You have Chagai, for example, speaking about the dire economic straits, much like Nehemiah refers to in Perek Hey when he's speaking about the efforts to rebuild the wall. And one of the things, I'm just going to jump down to the bolded pasuk in Pasuk Yud. What Chagai the Navi says is, after he describes how difficult it is, how they're working the lands and nothing is coming of it, he says, Al kein aleichem kal'u shamayim mital v'ha'aretz kal'a yivula. He says, therefore, he gives a reason for the reason that they're suffering. And what's his reason? If you look up a couple of psukim, the reason they're suffering is because they didn't channel all of their efforts into building the Beit HaMikdash. And I'm going to be paraphrasing most of these sources here. But the reason they're suffering and they're so poor is because when they came back to Israel, their first concern was building their own homes and securing their own safety and security, not building a home for God. And so, therefore, their punishment is that they're poor. Okay? Now, again, if you look, they're both reflecting the same reality. The same facts on the ground are there. Okay? We have a very different approach. If you think about it, really, the order of cause and effect is reversed. Okay? In Nehemiah, and you don't have it quoted here from Ezra, but in Ezra you have allusions to it too, that the reason it was so hard to build the Beit HaMikdash, the reason the building was delayed was because they were so poor, and people had to, really, all the manpower was left in the fields keep themselves, to sustain themselves. Okay? In Chagai Zechariah, you have the reverse. The reason they're so poor is because they weren't channeling the efforts into the building. Okay? And it really shouldn't surprise us, because Chagai was a Navi. Chagai was a prophet. And so what he's basically expressing to the people is a very basic thought in theology, or at least specifically in monotheistic theology, which is people suffer because of sins that they did. It's part of God's punishment for something you did wrong. Okay? And so Haggai is looking at the reality around him. Haggai is reacting to that reality, and he's giving the people a tool by which to change and to improve that reality. Okay? Nehemiah is looking at the very same reality. He's just reacting in a different way, or I should say at least the author of Ezra Nehemiah was responding in a more pragmatic, okay, in a more pragmatic fashion. Nehemiah really was, in many ways, at least at his roots, a political leader. He was from the upper echelons of the Persian society, and he was coming back to try to strengthen walls, to try to ensure the safety of the people. And so again, the facts are the same, but a slightly nuanced, a difference in ideology is expressed in the way that they reflect on the events around them. Okay? That's just by way of example. What I wanted to talk about tonight, and I think that's something that's very important, I think it's something that's really often underappreciated when we speak of Midrash. Midrash really, when we read it carefully, often picks up on these nuanced differences in the different works of Tanakh. And by the way, I think it goes without saying that it's not a question of which ideology. I mean, sometimes you could walk away saying, well, which one is right? Which was the correct order? It's not a question of right or wrong. Our job as readers when we learn Tanakh is to take a holistic approach. And so we look at all 24 books of Tanakh, and we can appreciate this sort of multifaceted world of thought and theology and ideology that makes up the basis of our religion. Okay, but the different Sarim really give us and break down those different dimensions into their component parts, which is, I think, part of the most fascinating things of Tanakh. One of the things that Midrash really does, I think that Midrash often is able to hone in on those differences that we may not notice at first glance. Okay, and they're able to sort of, by reading Midrash carefully, it almost serves as a magnifying glass or as a highlighter, sort of drawing into high relief those differences between the Sarim that seem at first blush to be almost identical or at least relatively similar. What I wanted to do tonight is look at a couple of Midrashim. And again, I'm going to be doing most of these outside. I just don't want to run out of time. I want to look at a couple of Midrashim, just a really, really tiny sampling of Midrashim that speak about Ezra. And I think what we're going to see as we read through them is a very subtle dialectic that arises when we look at the different Midrashim together. Okay? We're going to see that some Midrashim present Ezra in one dimension, and some of the Midrashim present him in a really opposing dimension. And I think what we're going to try to make sense of is not, again, it's not the question of which one is correct, but where in the text of Ezra Nehemiah do the authors of Midrash see these varying elements. So I wanted to start, if you look at your sources, you have, for example, on source 3. This is sort of like a question that many of you may be familiar with, because a very similar question is asked in the context of Abraham and Noah, right? You take two biblical personalities that lived at different times, and you say, well, had they existed in some, you know, vacuum where you had the same exact objective criteria, which one would be considered more righteous? Which one was better? Okay? And so you have that very same question in source 3. Hu Ezra lami Bavel, Ella Milamech Ilu Haya Harun Kayam, Ezra Hayaga Dolmi Menu Bidoro. Okay, a very bold statement. Okay, we're not going to speak now about the comparison specifically between Ezra and Nehemiah, between Ezra and Aharon, the most obvious one being that they were both Kohanim. But again, what I want to sort of focus on is the way in which Ezra is being placed in the category with these biblical greats. Okay, with these personalities that no one would ever think of questioning their righteousness, questioning their really authenticity as our biblical heroes. If you jump a little bit further down, this is something that when we begin to read Midrash, we realize that this is something that's really only done with biblical personalities. Just as halacha is deduced from the works of the Torah, of Tanakh, so too, what you often have are biblical personalities that become precedents, or the behavior of biblical personalities that becomes a springboard for a halachic discussion. Okay, so you have it, for example, where most of us are familiar with the very famous Midrash on Hannah and all the halachot we learn from Hannah and the way the mother of Shmuel and how she davened at the Mishkan in Shiloh. You have something similar here at the very jump to the bottom where it's bolded in source 4. It says, "V'chein hu omer ki Ezra hechin et levavo v'yitain lo hamelach ki yad Hashem." And again, this is sort of the end of a discussion about the appropriate way to daven. How do you daven? What is the appropriate way? What is considered kavanah, etc.? Okay, and so we see that not only is he being placed with the biblical greats, but he's being placed really firmly in their corner as a person that is weighed against someone like Aharon, as a person who can become a precedent for halacha, etc. A little bit later on, before I even get to that, one of the things that I'm going to be, a term that I'm going to be throwing out, and so I'm going to just digress here for like 30 seconds. One of the things that these biblical precedents become are almost paradigms, really, for rabbinic Jews. Okay? And I'm going to be throwing around the term rabbinic Judaism, so I just want to give a very, very brief and totally not do justice to that term in the next 30 seconds. Rabbinic Judaism is essentially, I'm gonna really just take a couple of highlights to get a sense, at least for the sake of tonight's discussion, why it's significant. Rabbinic Judaism is a phrase that we throw around that really, in our minds today, if someone asks what is mainstream Judaism, we don't even realize that what we're speaking of, that we are inheritors of Rabbinic Judaism. Okay? Rabbinic Judaism, for the most part, is an extension, it basically became mainstream with the codification of the Mishnah and the Gemara, but it really had its sort of predecessors in the period of the Second Temple with the Pharisees. I think that sometimes we like to think of Judaism as this sort of monolithic development, that from everything from Avraham and on was one nice, perfect, linear, straight line. And that's really not even close to the case. We know, particularly in the Second Temple period, that there were variant different sects that had very different beliefs and very different, all pious, all quote-unquote very religious Jews, but had very different approaches to Judaism. Rabbinic Judaism, essentially, with the Pharisees during the period of the of Bayit Sheni, and then really after the destruction of Bayit Sheni, Rabbinic Judaism, as I mentioned, emerges as mainstream. One of the things that Rabbinic Judaism, and again, this is, I'm barely scratching the surface, so please do not walk away thinking this is Rabbinic Judaism, but for the sake of tonight's shiur, one of the things that Rabbinic Judaism really, I would say, did most successfully, and really, or maybe take it from the other end, what enabled Rabbinic Judaism to survive when so many of the other sects really fell by the wayside, was that they created a portable Judaism, quote unquote. They reacted to the reality around them, to the notion of a diaspora Jewry, of really majority, actually, at that point, of the Jewish nation, not living in Israel, not having access to the temple, and they created a religion based on that reality, rooted in the past, rooted obviously in halacha, in the Torah, in tradition, etc., but they responded to the realities around them. And so, just by way of example, the notion that we have today of tefillah as replacing korbanot, okay, they came up with alternatives. They found meaning in a religion where many of the elements for much of the Jewish nation, even during the Second Temple, and absolutely beyond the destruction of the Second Temple, when many of those elements had been removed. And so they found meaning in a religion where so much of it had been taken away, much like we're going to go back to with Ezra and Nehemiah. So, for example, you have the topic of tefillah as replacing korbanot. You have the notion of liturgy, really, as being a standard, as being a unifying factor for the different communities throughout the diaspora. We're going to be coming to Yom Kippur not that far off, sorry to mention it. But you have, Yom Kippur, up really during the temple period, Yom Kippur was first and foremost, or I should say really only, a day that was about the avoda in the Beit HaMikdash. The Kohen Gadol, assuming the responsibility or accepting the responsibility to gain forgiveness for the entire nation. Okay, little by little, the Pharisees and then Rabbinic Judaism ultimately developed a very different way of understanding tshuva, of the individual being able to do tshuva, of the individual being able to connect to God in a meaningful religious way. Okay, and again, this did not happen by any means overnight. It was really a process, again, that began towards the end of the Second Temple period and then evolved and continued to evolve through those first few centuries after the discussion. Okay, one of the most important elements, or I would say dogmas, really, of Rabbinic Judaism, and again, this sort of is like goes without saying for us, but it wasn't necessarily always the case with everyone during those early years, is the notion that Hashem gave the Torah to Moshe at Har Sinai, plain and simple. Okay, Moshe was the only one that ever spoke Pe'el Pe' to Hashem. He was the only one that was on that level, that had that level of Nevuah. And then the sort of counterpart to that is the notion of Torah Sheba Al Pe'. Okay, the concept that God gave the elements of the written Torah to Moshe at Har Sinai, okay, but that the process of the interpretation of the Torah is something that continues beyond the days of Moshe, and that's transmitted from one generation to the next. Again, a given for anyone in this room, not necessarily always the case. Okay, I'm mentioning this because if we begin to look back at some of these midrashim, we're going to see that what we mentioned at the beginning is that Ezra initially was sort of grouped in the corner with all of the biblical greats. He was from the period of the biblical heroes. Okay? What we're going to notice, and this is what I was speaking of when I mentioned the dialectic, is that we're going to see that he was also pushed forward into, and I'm going to use this term very loosely, into the rabbinic period. Okay? If you look just by way of example, in source 5 it says, Rabbi Zeirav, Rabbi Hananel b'shem Rabbi, Afilu Adam Ragil B'Torah Ezra Lo Yehei Korei Mipiv V'Kotev. Okay, a halacha about a sofer, a scribe who's copying over a Torah. It says, even if you know the Torah as well as Ezra knew it, you can't, basically you're not allowed to write a Torah without having something else, without having an original to copy it from. Okay, and Ezra becomes associated very closely with the written text, so much so that he becomes really the standard. Okay, his knowledge of the written text of Moshe was impeccable. Okay, no one measures up, and he really, again, becomes this sort of barometer or the yardstick for any scribes that follow after him. Okay, and his connection with the written text is really stated very explicitly. In source 6, and I'm going to start skipping over because I noticed the time. Source 6, I'm just going to say outside, there's a whole debate about the script that the Torah was written in. Was the Torah originally written in one script and then changed into another, and there are debates about which the order was. One of the actions that's associated with Ezra, regardless of the direction in which the changing of the script went, one of the actions that's associated with Ezra was the changing of the script of the Torah to make it more accessible to the people. Okay? And so we see that not only was Ezra associated with knowing the text of Moshe, okay, flawlessly, but he's also associated with actually working with that text and manipulating that text to a degree as a means of making that text more accessible to the people, something which, again, was really the cornerstone of rabbinic Judaism. We're going to speak about that again in a couple of minutes. I'm going to give you one midrash that, unfortunately, Bar Ilan failed me today. I was not able to find it online. But there's a midrash from the Avot to Rabbi Natan. And he actually says something which is fascinating and very bold and may even come as, I think, a shock to some people. He says that he explains that the dots above the words in the Torah, what are they? Okay, he says that they're there because when Ezra was copying down the Torah, when Ezra was, as scribe, was writing down the Torah, there were a couple of psukim that he came to that he wasn't sure, do these really belong or do they not? And so what he did was put a dot above it, and then, God willing, when Eliyahu Anavi comes, right, Teku, he's going to answer all of the questions, and if they do belong, he'll leave them. If not, he'll remove those. And so we already see this being taken to the next level. Not only is Ezra closely associated with the text of the Torah, but Ezra himself is seen as manipulating that text, as being involved even on some level in the rewriting, again, always with the precedent of Moshe, but sort of being involved in a very real way in the rewriting and determining what belonged originally on that text. I think that something, I'm gonna skip over that very quickly. One of the things that I think is also very important, if we look, here, I'm just going to actually give you one very quick thing. Okay, if you just jump back for 1 second to source 6. Okay, again, a very bold statement. I don't know, you know, a question of how literally we have to take any of these things, but what we saw, very similar to the comparison between Ezra and Moshe, we see once again being made between Ezra and, between Ezra and Aharon, we see being made once again between Ezra and Moshe. Tani Rabbi Yossi Omer, Ra'oi Haya Ezra, Shetina Tein Torah Al Yadol Yisrael, Il Male Kidmo Moshe. Okay, a very bold statement that had Ezra come before Moshe, that it was just really, it was just happens, it was just a question of who came first, but had Ezra lived in the days of Moshe, he would have been the one to give the Torah. Okay, and so we see really a very bold statement, something unprecedented, because Moshe is usually, for the most part, untouchable. Moshe's role in Jewish history and Moshe's role in the giving of the Torah is, you don't go near that. Okay, and so this statement in and of itself really takes us aback initially. But I think that what's very important, and I think that what we sort of have to recognize is the way in which, and this is what I was mentioning in terms of thrusting Ezra forward into that next stage in Jewish history, is that in many ways what the Midrash is picking up on, and when I say Midrash, I mean sort of the entire, taking them all together, but what the different Midrashim are really picking up on are two very powerful elements in the work of Ezra Nehemiah. On the one hand, you have a very staunch commitment to the past, to the tradition, and we're going to speak about how that manifests. Okay? And so in that way, Ezra is really another point on that biblical continuum. Okay? At the same time, and sort of on the other end of the spectrum, you have in Ezra, who's involved in something that, as we mentioned, was really the hallmark of Rabbinic Judaism, which is the notion of taking a text that's in many ways incomprehensible, that, as we're going to see inside, really was at the risk in his day of becoming obsolete, which sounds crazy, but it was. Taking it and transforming it into a work that is accessible to the masses, which is also something unprecedented, which we're going to speak about, and not only accessible to the masses, but figuring out a way to include the people in the process of interpretation so that that archaic text remains relevant. Okay, something that we do without thinking about it, that was really in many ways an innovation, or at least was focused on much more so during these sort of early periods of the rabbinic, early years of the rabbinic period. And again, I think what the Midrashim notice is not specifically just about Ezra, this individual. I think that Ezra really is reflective of his time period, of what we're calling the period of restoration, when they first went back to Eretz Yisrael. And I think that what the Midrashim are looking at is how this time period reflected really that period of transformation from the past to the future. So what I wanted to do is I wanted to just look at a couple of examples of where we see this notion of continuity. Because clearly the Midrashim are seeing something in the text. Okay, so where do they see the continuity and where do they see the innovation? So if we look very quickly, you'll notice you have a chart in source 8. One of the things, and I think this is something that is most acute in the Sfarim of Ezra Nehemiah, but the truth is that we see this really throughout Tanakh. Okay? One of the ways, I shall say, in which Ezra Nehemiah really links what they were doing, the movements, the events of their day, to the past, is by linking them up with historical precedents that they felt matched or spoke to the significance of what they were doing. Okay? So I'll give a modern day example. I remember learning like years ago that when the Nuremberg trials were over, there was all this discussion about how the hanging of the Nazi war criminals was similar to the hanging of the 10 sons of Haman. Okay? And no one was making any real connection between them in terms of lineage or anything like that. But it was an issue of making sense of the present by reflecting on the past. When you talk about the hanging of the sons of Haman and the hanging of the Nazi war criminals, you're able to contextualize what's going on in your day. You're able to make sense of the import of that event. You're able to understand what they were threatening to destroy and what they were ultimately unable to destroy. Okay, and so contextualizing the present in our history is something that really lends significance and, again, helps us make sense of that which we're experiencing in the moment, and especially for bystanders, and it's something that we're going to see it goes on in Ezra Nehemiah. I saw just something that I think is actually very cool, but I just saw recently, but it speaks to, I think, the same idea. Someone could correct me if I misunderstood this article, but supposedly the Stuxnet virus, right, that they were, that supposedly, no one knows, but supposedly, Israel and the U.S. were in on this scheme together, and they somehow hacked into the files in the Iranian nuclear power plant and set them back by months in terms of progress. So allegedly, one of the files was named Myrtus, okay, which is the Latin root of the word myrtle, which is the name of Hadassah, which was the birth name of Esther, right? And so, again, whether or not that's the case, whether or not this is all just conspiracy theory, who knows? But, again, even if it is conspiracy theory, what it reflects is our need as Jews today to have something to hold on to believe that in the exact same geographical location where the Persians during the Persian reign where someone wanted to destroy us, but we had someone sneak in and preempt that attack, that today we can still accomplish that again. Okay, and so the past enables us to make sense of what we are living through in a way that enables us to move forward. So I wanted to just give a couple of examples of how they look back to the past and then really move on to the more important discussion, which is how they move forward. Again, I'm going to be summarizing, but it's all there for you. Source 8, you have two separate, I lined them up because they're really identical in terms of topic, okay? One of the things that Ezra and Nehemiah does, which is actually unique to Ezra and Nehemiah, in terms of how often they do it, Ezra and Nehemiah basically utilizes a lot of documents. It was actually something that was done throughout the Persian Empire, so it's not surprising, and it was done by Greek historians as well. But the Sefer Ezra Nehemiah itself utilizes actual documents as part of telling their story. Okay, what happens is sometimes inevitably you'll have the narrative retelling, which is the author of Nehemiah telling of their event in history, and then you'll also have a quotation at a different point of the actual document. And so what we're going to do is just notice the discrepancies between the actual documents, and in this case it's Cyrus's decree, okay, the original decree when he allowed people to return, and then Perek Aleph, which is the narrative retelling of that event. Okay, if you read through it inside, and you're going to do that on your own, one of the things that you're going to notice is that in Perek Aleph, there's a couple of elements that really jump out at us. The first one is the notion that God inspired Koresh to do what he did. Okay, God stirred the heart of Koresh, which is why he let the Jews go back to Eretz Yisrael. Okay, the obvious theological element. And then what's also very, very interesting is the way in which the Babylonian diaspora is the obvious recipient of this decree. Okay, they are the audience for this decree. Again, this is all in the narrative retelling. And so this is the shaping of the event by the authors of Ezra and Nehemiah. And perhaps most importantly, what I would say is that the building of the temple was really just the culmination, or I would say another point on this process, but that really the focus of the decree in many ways, according to this narrative portion, is the return from the foreign lands and this migration back to Eretz Yisrael. And by the way, again, this is exclusive to the narrative retelling. The people that really allowed for, or the people that financed this rebuilding, were none other than the diaspora jury. Okay? If we look at the actual decree of Cyrus, which is quoted years later during the reign of Darius, okay, and it's in Aramaic because it's most likely, if not the original, then very close to the original document, we notice that there are actually a couple of discrepancies. Okay? The diaspora is not necessarily the obvious audience. It could have just been a general proclamation. Okay? More important, and by the way, the building is really the only issue that's discussed. There's no notion of leave the land that you're living in, go back to the land where you came from. It's just plain and simple. Rebuild the temple that Nebuchadnezzar destroyed. And thirdly, it's made very clear by Cyrus in his own document that he and the royal treasury is going to be funding the building. Okay? Again, it's not a question of which is right and which is wrong, because in all likelihood, royal treasury probably did have to fund such a building project. But it's also very possible, for example, that the Jewish diaspora, the people that didn't go back, probably did help and make contributions. The point is that if we ignore Perek Vav for a second and look specifically at the way the event is shaped, okay, at the way the past is revisited and the way that the present is described, it's really in many ways very reminiscent of Yetziat Mitzrayim. Okay, of the idea of people living in a foreign land, of God getting involved and sort of forcing or compelling that foreign leader to allow them to migrate back to the country of their origins, to build ultimately the Beit HaMikdash. But along the way, and this is in your sources, source 9, the Mishkan, which was really the first, or you might say sort of stage 1 of the temple, the Mishkan was built by donations of the people. Okay, and so again, in many ways, it's not an issue of accuracy, it's an issue of which elements are highlighted. How is the author of Ezra and Nehemiah making sense of the return to build? This is seen in many ways as another exodus from Egypt, as another Yetziat Mitzrayim, and in that way, again, it creates a framework in which we can understand the import, or at least the people living through the event can understand the import of that event. Okay, I wanted to just give a couple of other examples. And again, I'm going to be skipping through many of them. If we talk about the dedication of Shlomo, the dedication that Shlomo made of the Beit HaMikdash, Okay, when he was done building the Beit HaMikdash. We have something very similar in source 11. I'm going to have you skip over source 10 just momentarily. In source 11, you have something very similar. One of the really central elements in Shlomo's dedication of his Chanukat HaBayit in Malachim was the notion that everyone sort of went to their appropriate positions. The Kohanim carried the Aron, and they stood where they belonged. The Levim did so in kind. So did the populace, etc. Okay? And when we have in Perek Vav of Ezra, when the temple is finally finished and they have their own dedication, you have something similar. It speaks about the Kohanim, the Levim, the people all going to their sort of appropriately appointed positions. Okay? It should come as no surprise that when later on, a little bit later on in the period of Ezra, that they sanctified the Beit HaMikdash, and there's this notion of separating from Tum'at Ha'aretz, okay, that the celebration of that sanctification happens on the holiday, and this is in your sources 12, happens on the holiday of Pesach, which is the exact same time that they celebrated the sanctification and the separating of Tumat Haaretz, both in the days of Chizkiyahu and Yoshiyahu, some of the last kings of the Davidic Empire prior to the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. Okay? And so many of the events, again, are sort of couched in these precedents. Okay, and that's really, in many ways, I think, speaks to this element of continuity, this element of understanding the present as almost being a part of what we might call the cycle of history. Okay, when we move on to innovations, though, what's very interesting is, and again, there's a lot of innovations that went on in the days of Ezra and Nehemiah. Just for the sake of clarity, I'm going to just go back to the ones that we just mentioned, because within the same event, you can have continuity and innovation. If we speak about the, for example, Yitziat Mitzrayim, and we said that it was very important for the author of Ezra Nehemiah to create this sense of this being another Yitziat Mitzrayim. Okay? In many ways, though, it really wasn't by any means another Yitziat Mitzrayim. Okay? Yitziat Mitzrayim was seen as this point of departure in history. Yitziat Mitzrayim was understood to change the reality of the world as people knew it. The nations of the world heard about it. Natural nature was turned upside down on its head. It was this cataclysmic event in history that nothing would compare to. Okay? If you look, and this is just by way of contrast, very quickly, and that you have actually in sources 13. If you look just at Shirat Hayam, that speaks to the cataclysmic nature of Yitziat Mitzrayim. If you look at source 14 by way of contrast, okay, again, Zechariah, we mentioned, was a contemporary, or at least wrote of the contemporaneous period of Ezra Nehemiah. Okay, when he speaks about the return, okay, when he speaks about what the rebuilding, what this period of restoration is about, you hear in the words of Zechariah elements of this sort of what you might even call eschatology, of this notion of the days as changing drastically from the way we know it, the way that it is now. Okay, and it speaks about lo chayamim harishonim ani l'sheiri ta'am hazeh, and it speaks about the way in which the nations of the world are going to recognize the greatness of Am Yisrael in a way that's unprecedented. And it speaks, if you jump down to the last pasuk, it speaks about tzom harvi'i and tzom hachamishi and tzom hashvi'i as being obsolete. Right, because the world will just be a different place, and there will be no room left for mourning. Okay, this is a contemporary. This is a man who lived during the restoration period, and this is how he describes what will take place when the Beit HaMikdash is rebuilt. Okay, if we look back at Ezra and Nehemiah, you don't have those elements of this cataclysm. You don't have these elements of the world is going to change and everything is going to be different. You have people who are looking at history as it's unfolding and reacting to that history, okay? They're not speaking of things changing forever. They're not speaking of the nations of the world bowing down to the nation of Israel. They're responding to the events as they see it, and they're ensuring the prosperity of the people. Yeah. Correct. Correct. And that's why it's not a question of one versus the other. But Ezra and Nehemiah are responding to that minority of people and a couple of other realities, which I'm going to speak to in a moment, which in many ways really were anticlimactic, if you think about it. But that's exactly what they're reacting to. But we're going to speak really about the nature of that reaction, which I think is the most important. If we look very quickly, and just again, I'm going to go back to a couple of the other. Events in history that I mentioned very, very quickly. If we speak about the dedication, for example, of the Beit HaMikdash, if you read through source 10 on your own tonight, Okay? What's going to strike you is that the main character of that perek is Shlomo HaMelech. Okay? Shlomo HaMelech built the Beit HaMikdash because a Navi told David that that's what he was going to do. He was the one that harnessed all of the manpower from throughout the country and beyond. He was the one that gathered all of the tools that needed to be utilized. He was the one that celebrated. He was the one that gave an entire perek worth of Tfilat Hashem. And the people, the populace, were for the most part really passive bystanders. Okay? If you look at the dedication inside, this is just by way of example in source 15. It says, Vayiga HaChodesh HaShvi'i, I'm in Pasuk Aleph in that first source, source 15, Vayiga HaChodesh HaShvi'i v'nei Yisrael be'arim, v'yeyasvu ha'am ki'ish achad el Yerushalayim. The process of this dedication, and by the way, the dedication was really the culmination of the building project, which was initiated by the people, and which was seen through till the end by the people. Okay? And then only after the people are gathered there do we hear the first name of the leader, Vayakam Yeshua ben Yotzadak, Ve'achav HaKohanim, Zerubbabel, etc. Okay? And so what we're noticing is that there's almost an eclipsing of the leaders, okay? Or perhaps even more importantly, the populace, the people. The notion that the building and the rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash was in many ways really a grassroots operation, that it was a bottom-up operation as opposed to a top-down one, is very, very important. The notion that they no longer needed to rely on that one king to be the figurehead for them, and again, this is not by any means to say that there weren't still leaders. They were, and they played an important role. But the leader as the central figure, obscuring the significance of the people, was no longer the reality that's being reflected. One of the things that's very interesting, and this is just from a literary perspective, we know that structure is always very important, that the author of any sefer is acutely aware of how they organize the different prakim. One of the things that's fascinating is that the entire episode of the rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash, all the way through its dedication, is sort of flanked, is enveloped on both sides by lists of the returnees, meaning extensive lists, registrars that we really don't have anything like that. We have Toldot in Bereishit, we have some lists in Bamidbar, but you don't really have lists of just father, son, to the degree that we have in Ezra Nehemiah. Lahavdil, obviously, but if you just look, for example, at Josephus very quickly, he believed his role to be as the role of a historian. And at one point when he was speaking, and this is a totally separate topic, but he happened to be speaking of an event in history, and he says, for example, which is what really is the intuitive way to write history is, and I'm going to paraphrase, he basically says, there were lots of people, but I'm skipping over the names because it's going to veer us off from the central narrative, from the point of the story. Okay? The author of Ezra Nehemiah didn't see the lists of people as tangential. Okay? The author of Ezra Nehemiah saw the names of the people as the story itself. They were now the central character. Okay? Just as Shlomo had been in the past, the people, the ones responsible for the building of the Beit HaMikdash and the dedication of it, they were the central element in the story. And so it wasn't veering us off, it was actually keeping us very focused. Okay? Very, very quickly, by the way, this whole notion, and with these last two points, I'm going to wrap up. We see that it's not only the downplaying, there's two really elements coupled with, or what I should say sort of parallels the accentuation of the importance of the people is the eclipsing and the downplaying of the leaders, okay? And particularly, by the way, anyone related to the Davidic dynasty, okay? Something we learn if you look very quickly in Divrei Hayamim source 17, what you'll notice is that Zerubbabel, who was one of the governors from the period of Ezra Nehemiah, was in fact the grandson of Yechaniah, Jehoiachin, one of the last kings of the Davidic dynasty, and in fact one of the only kings that survived during the exile that wasn't actually killed by the Babylonians. Okay? You will not find anywhere in Ezra Nehemiah the link between Zerubbabel and his royal bloodline. Never mentioned. It's mentioned in Divrei Hayamim. Ezra Nehemiah never speak of it. Okay? If you compare this, for example, to the dedication, go back to the dedication, for example, in Malachim. The dedication in Malachim of the Beit HaMikdash, you basically have the house of David, Beit David, and the Beit HaMikdash as inextricably linked. Okay, the two are inherently connected. And everything is basically reliant on and everything is basically dictated by the future and the prosperity of the Davidic dynasty. Okay? Ezra and Nehemiah are coming at a different point in history, and they're no longer pinning their hopes in the resurgence of this Davidic dynasty. And so they intentionally conceal. Again, a worldview is expressed not only by what's said, but by what's concealed. They are intentionally concealing Zerubbabel's links to the Davidic dynasty, okay, as a means of suppressing that, what you might call Davidic dynasty fervor. Okay? And by the way, it's not only, if you notice, just again, I'm going to go back to Haggai by means of comparison, or by means of contrast, really. If you look in Haggai, he pins all his hope, and you can read it in source 17, Haggai Perek Bet. He pins all of his hopes for this, as we spoke about, this changing of nature and upheaval in the world for the benefit of the Jewish people. He pins all of his hopes on this Zerubbabel, descendant of the Davidic dynasty. Okay? You don't have that in Ezra and Nehemiah. It's a very different reality, and they're responding and trying to cultivate a different ideology based on that reality. Very, very quickly, by the way, and it's not only the Davidic dynasty that's played down. Yeshua, we know from other sources, Yeshua was the Kohen Gadol, okay? But he's never referred to. The only time he's referred to as Kohen Gadol are in the documentation. In the narrative, he's just referred to as Yeshua, okay? Yeshua Kohen. So too, the Sheshbatzar and Zerubbabel were the two governors that had been appointed over the Judean province. Judea at that point was a province of the Persian Empire, and whether it was a separate province or not is a separate discussion, but there were governors, two of them being Sheshbatzar and Zerubbabel. The only time they're given, again, the appropriate title of governor of Pecha, okay, is when it's in the official Aramaic or the official documentation or transcription of that documentation. The narrative never refers to them as that. They're just given their first names. Okay, and so again, it's this very intentional suppression of the significance of leadership in that way. Very, very quickly, one of the last things that I think is most important, and with this we're going to wrap up. We mentioned in terms of the Torah, we spoke about the oral Torah and the written Torah, and we spoke very, very briefly about the way in which Rabbinic Judaism is really founded on the understanding that Torah needs to be transmitted from one generation to the next. What's very interesting, if we look, for example, at Matan Torah, okay, Matan Torah, if we remember what happens at Matan Torah, you have Moshe standing up on Har Sinai, getting the Torah directly from God and passing it on to the people. Okay? But again, it was initiated by God to Moshe and then handed over to the people. And by the way, in between Moshe and the people, if you look, for example, in your sources 18, okay, source 18, the keepers of the law, okay, this is something that we sometimes forget because we associate Kohanim, we think of them as just wearing white in the Beit HaMikdash. But the Kohanim really were the quote-unquote keepers or the guardians of the law. Okay? If there was a halacha, if there was a ruling that the zekenim or the people themselves did not know how to rule, okay, they went to the Kohanim. The Kohanim were the ones that held the law. The Kohanim were the ones that passed law from father to son. They were the ones that had knowledge of the text of the Torah. And they were the ones that people sought out to answer their questions when they didn't have the answers. Okay? One of the things that we'll notice, in Ezra Nehemiah, is a very different, quote-unquote, giving of the Torah, okay? When Ezra comes back, as I mentioned, the Torah was really on the verge of becoming obsolete. People not only didn't know how to read the Torah, they hadn't seen it or heard from it in years, and it was a document that they were completely unfamiliar with, which is why the Midrash probably speaks of the idea of changing the script so people could even read the Torah, okay? When Ezra comes back, he has this rededication of the Torah that's spoken about in Nehemiah, in the second portion of the book. And if we look at it very quickly, just look at source 19 for one second. In source 19, I think that we see really this paradigm shift that we've been speaking of most profoundly. It says, "Vayasfu kol ha'am ki'isha chad al harachov asher lifni shar ha'mayim vayomru le'ezra ha'sofer lehavi et sefer torat Moshe asher tziva Hashem et Yisrael." Okay? It's initiated, again, by the people. They come to Ezra, who is the sofer. By the way, he was a Kohen and a sofer. His role as Kohen, as keeper of the Torah, is downplayed. His role of sofer, as scribe and teacher of the Torah, is played up. Okay, his lineage was impeccable, but only one aspect of that lineage is highlighted in this case. Vayavi Ezra Kohen et haTorah lefnei haKohel me'ish v'ad isha v'chol mivin lishmo biyom echad l'chodesh hashvi'i. Vayikra bo lefnei harachov asher lefnei shar hamayim. And it goes on, and he basically speaks of Ezra educating the people from morning until night. Not just reading it to them, it wasn't simply a hakel, he was actually educating the people in the text of the Torah. Perhaps the most profound implication of this paradigm shift is found at the end of that parak in Pasuk Yud Zayin. In Pasuk Yud Gimel, that third paragraph that's bolded. It says, "Uvayom ha-sheni ne'esfu rashei ha-avot l'chol ha'am ha-kohanim v'ha-levim el Ezra ha-sofer u'la-haskil el divrei ha-torah." They came back to him. Now a second time, because they wanted to learn more, because they wanted to understand, because they didn't want to have the Torah remain in the hands of the few. They wanted that paradigm shift. They craved it. Vayimtzu katuv. Now this is fascinating. Vayimtzu, the populace, the people who were engaged in this process of interpretation. Vayimtzu katuv b'Torah asher tziva Hashem b'yad Moshe asher yeshvu b'nei Yisrael b'sukot b'chag b'chodesh hashvi'i. Suddenly they found this long-lost pasuk that says that they're supposed to be sitting in booths on this holiday of Sukkot. Vasher yashmiu vayaviru kol b'chol areihim uv'yushayin le'mor tzu ha'har v'haviu alei zayit. And that became the impetus for the people to re-establish the holiday of Sukkot. And so they go out and they get all of the symbols necessary and they celebrate what was probably for the first time in close to a century, the holiday of Sukkot. Okay? Again, it was initiated by the people. They elicited it from Ezra, and their recognition of this gulf that existed between what the Torah demanded and what they were actually doing was so great that they themselves wanted to make that change. Okay? If you just compare, and again, there were a number of times throughout history prior to the Korban where you had a leader, a Navi, or a king coming and castigating the people and rebuking them and telling them that, again, this gulf that the people in Ezra and Nehemiah noticed on their own existed. If you just look, I mean, just for example, if we talk about in the days of Yoshiyahu. Yoshiyahu's reform is one of the most famous reforms. Okay, they find the Sefer Torah in the Beit HaMikdash. Shafan HaSofer finds the Sefer Torah, right, the famous story, and they bring it to Huldah HaNeviah, and she says, oh, this is very bad. It was probably a portion from Devarim. She says, again, the tochacha, what God says you should be doing, does not match up with what you're doing, and this is just terrible. And so it becomes really the impetus for the reform that Yoshiyahu leads, and it's a top-down reform. Okay, it comes from the leader. He rebukes the people, he reproaches them for their behavior, and he tries to compel them to reform. Okay, even though Chulda anticipated this, what we find out is that it was really a very short-lived reform, and the Korban followed very, very shortly after. Okay? If we look, I think perhaps the most powerful pasuk in this entire Sefer, and what I think really speaks most profoundly to what Ezra and Nehemiah, what the Sefer really understood, what the authors of the Sefer understood, what the leaders understood, and why I say this is the precursor to Rabbinic Judaism, it's found in pasuk 10, okay, back in that source 19. You have the leaders, and again, the leaders understood implicitly that the people were dismayed is an understatement, that the people were terrified, ashamed, saddened, whatever the words are, by the reality that hit them, that they had strayed so far from that covenant with God. And so Pasuk Tet, it says, Vayomer Nehemiah hatirshata v'ezra ha-kohen ha-sofer v'ha-levim ha-mevinim et ha-am l'chol ha-am. Okay, and they say as follows, Hayom kadosh hu la-Hashem Elokeichem. Al titablu ve'al tivku, ki bochim kol ha'am kisham amet divrei ha-Torah. The people heard the words of the Torah and they started crying. And Ezra and Nehemiah and the leaders, they say, don't cry. Okay, why not? Vayomer lahem lichu ichlu mashmanim ushitu mamtakim v'shilchu manot l'ein achon lo ki kadosh hayom la'adoneinu. Today is a holy day to our God. Ve'al teyatzvu. I think, again, this is the most important part. Ki chedvat Hashem hi ma'uschem. Because rejoicing with God is your strength. I think that what makes Ezra and Nehemiah stand out, what the Midrash recognized by sort of taken together by posing that dialectic, and I think what really, in many ways, and again, I can't stress this enough, I think that the ideology of Ezra and Nehemiah really served as the prototype for what emerged later when the Jews had to contend, when the leaders really had to contend with the realities of the Second Temple, of losing their sovereignty, and ultimately of losing the Beit HaMikdash entirely, is a notion that the past is important, and the past roots us in the present, and the past enables us to make sense of our present, but that if we get bogged down in the past, if we get so mired in the past, if we spend all our days in the present wishing that things were like they were in this idyllic past that we remember, then we're going to get stuck and we won't be able to move forward. And I think Ezra Nehemiah's response, I think the response of the leaders to the people when they were crying, when they realized that gulf that existed, and what they said to them was, you can't lament that you're not where you want to be yet. You have to rejoice in what you're doing at the moment. You have to rejoice in your ability in this moment to respond to your reality. You have to come up with creative ways to exist within your reality, okay? And in that way, you will be able to survive, and you will be able to recreate those sentiments that you're holding on to so dearly. I think that if we think about really rabbinic Judaism, you know, again, I think it's just another point in history, but I think it's really on the same trajectory. I think it's based on the same ideology of responding to your reality and being able to make sense of it, and being able to remain rooted in the past, but also be able to move your foot to the next step forward. I think that that is what really has enabled us to exist, to endure. It's what has sustained us all these millennia. And if we're able to internalize really what Ezra and Nehemiah did in their day, I think it'll enable us to continue way beyond. Oh, sorry, questions? Anyone, if you're not falling too good? Yeah. You look so familiar.
Eileen Wexler.
Oh, Nava. Yeah, okay, because I met you, I think. Yes. Oh, she's good. How's she doing? She got married already?
Yeah, she wanted me to say hello. She's all excited.
Where's she living?
The Heights.
Very nice. Oh, Nava.
Thank you.
There, send her my regards. Thank you. I thought if I came back there, no one will notice.
So she's done though. She graduated. What was she doing? I know something cool she told me.
Just Macy's.
Yeah. That's cool though. She looks a lot like you.